This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here till 2 p.m. Today's program is pretty much a poetry program. We had one of these about a month and a half ago, but none of the poets were there. It was all recorded readings. This evening, or this afternoon, three of the four will be with us, and the fourth will be with us through one of the others. In the second half of the program, I'm going to be talking with local poets Christine Irving and Noel Kroplin, who are going to be reading this Saturday from their new chapbook, Sex on Earth, at Rhythms Cafe in Grass Valley. In the first half of the program, I'm going to be talking with David Young, who's Professor Emeritus of English at Oberlin College in Ohio, author of half a dozen books of his own poetry, more than that of translations of other people, as well as the critical studies that English professors turn out every now and then. Welcome to Booktown, David Young.
Thank you.
Your new book is one I've been waiting for years. It's called Du Fu, A Life in Poetry, in which you take the poems of the person the Chinese consider their greatest poet and just put them in chronological order with a few comments, and it gives us a wonderful view of his life, probably as comprehensive as you can get. Anyway, what led you to this?
Well, I've been translating Chinese poetry off and on since the late 1960s, and the poets of the Tang Dynasty have been my particular interest, and I've sometimes collaborated with other scholars and so forth. But I have a book called Five Tang Poets that includes Du Fu, and a friend of mine singled out the translation of Du Fu in that book and said, you know, you ought to do an entire book of his at some point. And I found that idea scary because he is like Shakespeare or Dante to the Chinese. But I kept on reading him, and I kept on accumulating versions of his poems, and I gradually kind of got up my nerve to do this project and eventually picked 170 poems out of the 13 or 1400 that constitute his canon. And as you say, I put them in chronological order and arranged them so that a reader could follow the arc of his life through his work.
Now, the Chinese have always considered, not always, but certainly for the last 1,000 years or so, considered him their greatest poet. In the West, he's not nearly as well known to most readers as especially some of his contemporaries like Li Bai or Wang Wei or Bai Jui, Han Shan. Why do you think he's been neglected in the West?
Well, I wouldn't say neglected, because there are three or four books in print that are, you know, selected poems of Du Fu. What I think happens, though, is that we see him here and there. We see him in anthologies. We get glimpses of his work. And what the Chinese value, I think, about him is the fact that through the course of his life, he developed so prodigiously in terms of how he handled poetic form and what he considered suitable subject matter. And I think that kind of awareness has been lacking. That's what my book tries to address, because I think their sense of his greatness is based not so much on this or that individual poem as on the size and comprehensiveness of his canon.
And one of his great achievements is he may have been one of the great technical innovators in Chinese poetic history, and one of the people who brought a lot of ordinary topics into poetry. They've been copied so often that if you see them in a Western anthology, they pretty much sound like the generic Chinese poet.
That's right, yeah. We don't know when we read, say, a Rub poem written to his wife that it might be the first such poem in Chinese, or when he writes about very mundane subjects of domestic life or gardening or whatever. Again, that he is broadening the scope of Chinese poetry significantly. Chinese poets ever since have benefited from that, but we don't necessarily have a way to kind of mark those moments of innovation.
And I know I never really appreciated him. I've been reading him until I actually got to go and see some of the places where he had written some of the poems, in particular his thatched cottage in Chengdu.
Chengdu, yeah.
But if I'd had your book in advance, I might not have needed that, because it does anchor the poems very concretely. And you
I have tried. Yeah, I've even got a map so that a reader can follow him, you know, geographically. And I'd love to myself be able to take a trip or lead a trip, you know, to follow in Dufu's tracks or footsteps, but I've never had a chance to do that.
The other thing you notice, or I notice in the book that I hadn't before, is the progression, that his first poems were definitely written for court life and mostly about court life with sort of cliched sentiments about the transience of life or how much nice it is to drink wine with your friends. But then as he struggled on, the poems get much more individual. There's much more, as you said, recognition of ordinary life. And toward the end, the last few poems, most of which I'd never read, are almost luminous in their just sort of simple acceptance.
I agree, yeah. And I guess we have to conclude that the adversity that first kept him from getting a good court appointment, and then the adversity caused by the, I guess we could call it, civil war in China, that sent him out on the road with his family trying to protect them and trying to find some livelihood, contributed to his poetry, because he got to see more of the country, and he couldn't write from the complacency of the capital. He encountered ordinary people and their lives and wrote about them with enormous compassion and sympathy. And again, that made him unlike so many of the poets of his time. Early in his life, he did meet Li Bai, and Li Bai was also kind of too original to stay in the capital and be around the court. So in a sense, he had a role model early on of an alternative way of being a poet from what was considered kind of the standard thing. You took the imperial exam, you passed it, you got a nice post, and you lived luxuriously in the capital. And since that never worked out for him, he could at least say to himself, well, it didn't work out for Li Bai either, and look where he got to. He's the best living poet, until Dufu came along.
And how do you get into that? Yeah, I take it from just reading about you that you've never formally studied Chinese, but you've picked up a fair amount along the way.
Right.
How do you approach his poems? And as a poet yourself, how do you decide how to present them, I should say?
Right. Well, again, there's no simple answer to that. I approach him from every angle and direction I can think of, through scholarly discussions, through other translations, through the Chinese, when I have the patience to look up the characters and you know, wade through. But I've benefited from the fact that there has been a fair amount of scholarship and translation already, and that I could use that to sort of try to get my sense of this poet going. And then, of course, I think the more I've worked on Chinese poetry, and especially Tang Dynasty poetry, the more I've become comfortable with a sense of what their conventions and traditions and forms were like, and comparably how that might be handled in English, so that a reader would not get everything, because obviously there's no substitute for reading the original, but get a sense of how the poetry has both a formal and an informal aspect simultaneously, and that's a little hard to do in English. So many Chinese translations fall on one side or the other.
Right. And I've tried translating a few, and none have been satisfactory. I've tried doing them as literally and tersely as possible. And it sort of pleases me, but I don't think it would please anyone else. There's one of your poems, The Rain on a Spring Night. I said your poems because, in a way, that it literally is good rain knows the season. At spring, it happens. And you took a big jump and you said, congratulations, rain, you know when to fall. And you know quite well you belong to spring, which I think is, it actually jarred me a bit the first time I saw it. But the more I looked at it, the more I liked it.
Well, good. Because it is, it is a bit of a jump, and I think it might startle some Chinese scholars or readers who want something more literal. But I'm trying to find an equivalent in our current language that reflects what I think is there in the Chinese, and that is this kind of amazing scope and originality that makes Du Fu so beloved to the Chinese.
Now, I've only read a few of your poems, mostly on the Academy of American Poets website, poems.org, and they are quite expansive. You write in a loose, sort of generous style, I would say, and I had the feeling that maybe you were sort of unpacking Du Fu in a little bit to make him fit more to an American sensibility.
Well, certainly... I'm comfortable writing poems that seem more or less consistent with my understanding of what our poetry is like now. And I admire other poets who translated. I think I first read Du Fu in Kenneth Rexroth's translations. And those are very free in a way, and they very much reflect Rexroth's own sensibility. And Gary Snyder's translations of Han Shan and so forth and so on. And Pound, I think a poet has to try to use whatever skills he or she has developed in the course of, a lifetime of trying to write poems and try to bring those to bear. If they were not allowed to be part of the translation experience, then presumably the translations might suffer. But I'm always ready to admit that my Du Fu is not the Du Fu or everyone's Du Fu, and I always encourage people who are interested in poets I like and have translated to not just read one translation, but to kind of try to surround the original. So I'm happy to recommend Burton Watson's translations of Du Fu and Kenneth Rexroth's and David Hinton's, because I think, a Chinese poem is something that you interpret as you read it, even if you know the original. No two readers are going to come up with quite the same understanding of a Chinese poem. And the openness of the language and of those poetic texts, I think, means that translators can, kind of follow their instincts, and translations cannot be definitive, but can be evocative of maybe the time and place where they were done.
And that's even true of modern Chinese when they read classical poems. They can't always tell you exactly what something would mean if they were translated into colloquial.
Right.
Now, I remember when I read Rexroth's translations, 100 Poems from the Chinese, 40-some years ago, it made a strong, those and the Arthur Whaley translations made a strong impression on me. But when he said that he'd been reading Du Fu for decades and how much he'd loved him from the very beginning, although his Chinese was, he was working through other people also.
Very often.
And I couldn't really appreciate him in his versions because I thought they really were very loose in... He'd move images from one place to another, and the lines didn't have the same structure. Even though you're looser, your lines, two of your lines equal one Chinese line.
That's true.
In almost every case.
Yes, yeah. I treat the Chinese line as a free verse stanza, usually of two lines, sometimes of three.
Yeah, because most Chinese lines are broken in the middle anyway, so it's almost like each single line is a couplet.
Right.
And you've treated it that way.
Yeah. Now, that gives me a lot of flexibility, and I guess I'd agree. I wouldn't recommend that somebody do it the way Rexroth did it. But at the same time, some of the power of the poems does come through, even though he enjams lines, and as you say, he sometimes leaves things out, or he excerpts without, you know, indicating that it's not the whole poem, and so forth and so on. So, you know, I can carp with him, and I can carp with Whaley, and I can carp with Pound, but at the same time, I feel like I stand a little bit on the shoulders of those people, so I don't want to be too negative about them.
Now, you say you've been translating Chinese poetry from the 60s. You've also translated a lot of European poetry, most notably Petrarch, Rilke, Miroslav Holub. What's the difference?
Well, good poetry is good poetry. I think in the case of Chinese, the distinctiveness has to do with the nature of their language, which is very, very remarkable, and the poetic tradition that language gave rise to. It's harder in some ways. I mean, here I am talking about somebody who lived in the 8th century, and yet his poems still speak to us. So that's a testimony to the incredible vigor and accomplishment of that poet in that period. But when I read, and of course Petrarch too is 14th century, so
right.
That's pretty distant. But when I mean, with Miroslav Holub, I knew the man, so I could ask him about a hard place, or we could discuss how an image ought to be handled. And there's a great pleasure to that too. It's a different kind of thing. But I think in every case, you could say, well, I'm a poet and I am trying in my own language to recreate the creative process that led to the poem in the other language, and that allows me to kind of hang out with that poet and get to have some knowledge of that poet's mind and imagination. And that's a great pleasure. That's very rewarding. I mean, it isn't easy to translate 366 poems in medieval Tuscan. It took me a long time to do the Petrarch, but when I was done, I felt like I really, really knew Petrarch and his world and what it was about him that was so original and distinctive.
And in his case, you were able to translate a sonnet as a sonnet with...
I didn't keep the rhyme scheme, but
exactly.
I kept the meter, yeah. The rhyme schemes are just too demanding in English, and they make you distort the sense. So that was my compromise there.
And in that case, it's sort of like the skeleton of both poets you keep there, of the form, as opposed to somebody like Holub writes in many, many forms, depending on what he's writing about.
Right, right. Holub's work is more or less free verse and sometimes even prose. So there were not issues of what would be comparable in English. When I first got started translating, I did Rilke's Duino Elegies, and I handled Rilke's long line using William Carlos Williams' triadic line. And that was controversial. Some lovers of Rilke and some poets urged me to move away from that, and yet readers found it a very effective, again, I guess I used to use the word compromise, between long lines and short lines, and I was able to produce something that really held the reader, so I went ahead even though, as I say, there were some objections. It's hard to write long lines with American speech because we speak in small, fragmentary sort of bursts. And Williams figured out that three of those could make a long line with, you know, steps down. And so for his late work, he was able to develop a very sort of fluent, sweeping, almost plangent style and still work with those short units that he had learned to master early.
When you write your own poems and when you translate somebody else's, what's the difference? Well, there's two differences. What's the difference in feeling, and what's the difference in who you're writing for?
Well, I don't know that there's that much difference in who I'm writing for, because I guess both the translations and my own poems are for what I hope is some kind of ideal reader who's my own contemporary or who may be around after I'm not here anymore. But I do think, yeah, the experience is my own poems come to me, they sort of come out of nowhere, and they arrive as great, you know, gifts, and sometimes they arrive suddenly and sometimes they arrive slowly, and it's an agonizing process. But with the translations, I have already a bearing. I have something that's there that I know I can work with, and that allows me to still use some of the same skills I'd use for writing my own poems, but in a way it's more of a set thing. So I'm crafting, but I'm perhaps not as inspired or you know, not quite making the same sort of discoveries that I might make in my own poems.
Do you ever get inspirations that you say, oh no, I've got to throw that out because it's not close enough to the original?
In translations, yeah, I have. Well, for example, in this new book, The Du Fu, there are a number of poems that were already in my Five Tongue Poets, which was first published in 1980 as Four Tongue Poets, and then again in 1990. Well, I went back to the Du Fu versions in that book as I was putting this one together, and I felt, no, there are a few cases where I can be more accurate. So I revised my own translations accordingly, because I was, at that point, then further into Du Fu and able to be more precise about exactly what he was saying.
Although one of the things that part of his reputation in Chinese poetry, in not only is Chinese poetry as a whole very elusive and ambiguous and a little hard to translate into colloquial Chinese, mm-hmm. he was considered to have stretched the language farther than anyone who'd gone before him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's partly a matter of form and partly a matter of subject matter and partly a matter of tone. I talk in my introduction about a poem that a short poem in which I point out that there are several switches of tone just in this little poem, and you'd hardly notice it because it seems so effortless.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're working on him and you're sort of tracking him, you realize that he's capable of wonderful sort of transformations. He'll go from one emotion to another, from hilarity to sorrow, and then on to something else, all in very short order, and all using very simple means. That fascinates and sometimes mystifies me. So I think, I guess I would say, getting his tones right was one of my biggest challenges and one of my greatest pleasures when I felt I had accomplished it.
The one you're talking about is I Am a Madman.
Yes, right.
Excuse me. I happen to have it in front of me, and it does fall into three parts. I'll just read it, and you can comment a bit mm-hmm. after we're done, unless you'd like to read it.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll open to the introduction. This is part of his life when he's fairly far along in his life, and he's come to a sort of tranquil few years where he built a cottage and lives by a river and has a very sort of happy rural life with his family. But he's always worried. He's always worried about the national, you know, disorder, but he's also just worried about feeding his kids. This poem seems to touch on his rural pleasures and then on those worries and his distance from the capital and the court, and then come to some kind of strange resolution of it. It's called I Am a Madman. My thatched cottage stands just west of Thousand Mile Bridge. The Hundred Flower Stream would please a hermit fisherman. Bamboo sways in the wind, graceful as any court beauty. Rain makes the lotus flowers even more red and fragrant. But I no longer hear from friends, who live on princely salaries. My children are always hungry, with pale and famished faces. Does a madman grow more happy before he dies in the gutter? I laugh at myself, a madman growing older, growing madder.
And there are three very distinct sections of that. The first,
right. First, he takes pleasure in his surroundings, but then this does remind him of the court beauties. So he complains about his estrangement from all that, and then he thinks of his family, and then he somehow turns back and finds happiness, paradoxically, unaccountably, and laughs at the end of the poem. Growing older, growing madder. That poem was included in the Buddhist magazine Shambhala Sun, because I think the editor felt that there was something Buddhist about the sensibility and understanding behind it. And while Dufu was not a strict or practicing Buddhist, he was aware of Buddhism, as he was also aware of Taoism and Confucianism. I can see why that editor liked that poem from the Buddhist perspective.
And you do mention that, like most Chinese officials, his Confucianism was sort of the default set of observations.
Right.
But he moved in the other directions toward Buddhism and Taoism.
Yes.
Constantly. And he certainly appreciated he seemed to get more solace from Buddhism and Taoism than he did from Confucian practices.
Yes. I agree. Yeah.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking for the last 20 minutes or so with David Young, Emeritus Professor of English at Oberlin College, translator of numerous Western and Chinese poets, and of author of half a dozen books of his own. Well, I guess it's four books exactly here. And he has most recently come out with Dufu, A Life in Poetry, which has just been published by Knopf, and contains, how many was it?
170.
170 representative poems of Dufu, including some of his most famous ones, which are sort of more political and probably wouldn't touch Westerners as much, like The Capital is Destroyed, but the Mountains and Flowers Live On, I think has a resonance for Chinese it wouldn't have for us.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many in here, I think the personal ones in particular, and it's a fascinating view of the life of a person I wanted to know more about, and now I think I do.
Great.
Okay, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you for another 25, 26 minutes. In the second half of the program, I was planning to talk with the two women who are going to be reading this coming Saturday at Rhythms Cafe in Grass Valley, but only one of them is here, Christine Irving. That's fine, because Christine's an old friend, and I know we can talk for quite a lot. I'm a little disappointed that Noel... Does she say Croplin, or how does she pronounce
Croplin.
It? Croplin is not here. We would have liked to have heard her take on this a bit and heard her reading, but we're going to let Christine read a bit at the end of the program and, in the meantime, talk about these poems and how they came about. The chapbook is called Sex on Earth and Other Sordid Locations. It's one of the Cheap Shots Poetry Series, number 5 of 6 Foot Swells Press. There's so many logos and trademarks on this almost. It's Cheap Shots Poetry Series of 6 Foot Swells Press. It's also part of their After Hours Poetry. So if you can put all that together, what do all those things mean?
Well, I'm not one of the publishers, so I can't really speak for them, but I think they sort of invented the genre, or named it, of after-hours poetry, which I thought was extremely clever of them to find a new niche. And I think they like to write about, you know, that late night, bluesy, funky kind of time, and lost loves, and the kind of feelings you get late at night when you've been drinking for a long time, that sort of thing.
The poems I've read by the publishers sort of fall somewhere between Brodigan and Bukowski.
Yes, yes. I think they're big Bukowski fans.
So how did you come to be part of this series? I never thought of you as an after-hours person necessarily.
Well, I've had my moments, but no, it's not my regular scene. I kind of slid in the back door. Todd and I have read together a couple of times, and I've read for the Nevada County Poetry Series, so they know my work. And Todd and I read at Erotique up on the Ridge for a couple years, and so they just thought I might fit in.
And they suggested that you and Noel work together, that you share the chapbook?
They did. And I don't know Noel well, but I've heard her read on a number of occasions, and I think she's a lovely poet.
We're looking out the window to see if that's her. No, it's someone else. Someone who knows how to get in, so it can't be her. And the topic, Sex on Earth, was that their idea, your idea, joint idea?
Actually, it was their idea. They had several titles, and we voted on them.
Had you already picked the poems before the title came up, or did you choose them to fit the title?
No. We'd already sent in our poems. We both sent in a number of poems, and they decided which ones they wanted to include.
And they all do have a sort of sexual component, although sometimes it's pretty broadly interpreted. Some of them are very explicitly physical. So, there's a couple we can't read on the air. But there's others that, like I think the one you're going to read tonight, which is one of those after-hours bluesy feeling.
Yeah,
sometimes. That has all the emotions, but none of the, well, the physicality is sort of hovers over it. And I know of Noel's ones, one of her long ones in here is What I Want According to Google, which is a delightful list of all the things she wants, like, I want my mass resistance, I want to leave a mark on the world, I want our Marines, Air Force, and Army home, I want to embrace Islam, but there are no Muslims in my town, and so on. I want to be Stephen Colbert's gamer friend, which you can draw all sorts of desire and maybe a bit of libido out of them, but it's pretty wide-ranging. Go on.
Well, it's just interesting. The whole notion of the erotic, you know, and how much of it can be done implicitly, and how different it is when it's direct. It's interesting to play with it both ways.
Yeah, and one of your most direct ones, and one of my favorites in here, is Seasonal Sex, an instruction manual, which is pretty graphic, but it could be read on the radio, I think. That's not the one you're going to read. But it's delightful because each poem starts out, those wishing to make love in the summer, or those wishing to make love outdoors in the afternoon, for each of the seasons. And there are almost as much nature poems as they are sex poems. And I guess that all makes sense. So I should say, what do you most like to write about? Since these poems were the choices of the editors, and they were far from everything you've written, they pick things with a certain slant, but you range a lot wider than that.
Well, basically, I'm a storyteller. So, you know, in painting, you've got genre paintings, which are these small scenes, and that's what I really like to write my poetry about. And this particular genre of after-hours poetry is interesting from an artistic point of view because you have a certain boundary, you know, and then you can go you can imagine the boundary. I mean, everybody's been in a bar. Most people have been in a bar. I've been in lots of them. And I've read a lot. So I can go into that imaginary place and then see what happens and what story emerges out of that scene. So that's kind of what I do. But I also write a lot of goddess-oriented things and a lot about women's lives.
And we're getting a very insistent phone caller, and I don't always pick up the phone, but I'm going to in this case and see who's there. Hi, caller. You're on KVMR.
Hi there. This is Todd Cirillo.
Aha. You can fill in the blanks.
I will. I could certainly try, yeah.
Todd is one of the publishers of 6 Foot Swells.
Yep, myself and the poet Julie Valin and Matt Amott started the press. And it's been incredible. As Christine said, you know, the idea of place and what you guys said about, we first met Christine at another book release of ours for Cocktails and Confessions, and her work literally was like almost left you smoldering and crying for more, you know. And so
you cried for more.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's a real compliment in the way that her poems also work with Noel's, and then also the other book that we'll release on that same day too, Will Staples, the one that got away. But it's just really about having a good time, and I think Christine has really worked well with us in promoting this idea or this niche that we have about, you know, creating a community through having a great time.
You agree with that, Christine?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think play and fun and sensuality are absolutely important components in bonding and friendship and just hanging out. We need to hang out together a lot more than we do.
Absolutely. And those are what our readings are. Our readings are a little bit more upbeat than the normal poetry readings, a little more interactive. The book release parties are really a way to, you know, get back in touch with poets and friends and some ex-lovers we may or may not want to see, but they show up anyhow. And to really, you know, Will Staples said this weekend that After Hours poetry is more than just this seedy sort of barroom stuff. It's really material that is less censor than the rest. And I like that. I agree with that.
So, Christine, what are you going to do at the reading? You can't... Well, a chapbook is pretty short. You could, between the two of you, probably read most of it. Are you going to concentrate on it, or are you going to read anything from other writings?
We'll have a new poem that I really love that was a fun collaboration, really. I'm about collaboration. You know, that... And I was in a class recently where we got lines from different people, and then we had to create a poem out of the lines, and that's always a lot of fun for me. So and it fits in. So I'll probably sneak that one in.
I hope she reads lots of new poems.
Okay, because you know the old ones already.
Well, you know,
and you're crying for more.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Christine is definitely a poet that I always like to come out for to hear, and especially to hear the new stuff, because she always blows at least me away, and I know Julie also. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to the reading.
Now, I always think of Will Staples' poems as more being about disappointed love rather than fulfilled, whereas you and Noel have some of both, but it's much more anticipating a good time or anticipating a closeness or an excitement. Are you going to all be there? You're all going to be there together. Are you going to be two halves, the anticipation and the disillusionment?
Well, I don't know. It'll all work out the way it does. It's always interesting. You know, you get in the room and you have this audience and there's the interaction and magic starts to happen and there's a flow that's different every time. So I can't really predict how it's going to turn out.
Okay, well, we've got another insistent caller, and I'm going to see if I can keep Todd on the phone and get this other. We'll see. Hello, other caller. Are you here?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I was just listening to you interviewing David Young about the Dufu poetry.
Right. Well, can you call back later about that?
Yes.
Okay, because I'm going to continue on with the people who are talking here now.
Oh,
thank
okay,
you.
Fine. Uh-huh, okay. Bye-bye.
I was hoping in the back of my mind that might be Noel.
Yes, me too.
But we have Todd for just a short time longer. Did you decide to publish Will's chapbook and Christine and Noel's at the same time, or did it just happen?
What originally happened was we were going to do them at separate occasions, but then the whole idea of, especially once we saw it was coming into winter, you know, why not go into winter with a huge bang and do a two-for-one happy hour and, you know, sort of give us that poetry hangover that'll get us through until spring. And so, I've seen Will also read with Noel, and they really are champions up on the stage and work well together, and I know that the three of them, it really is just going to be a great, every book complements the other one, and each of the three poets there really, I think, have been around long enough to work just exceptionally well together.
We're talking about the two-for-one happy hour reading at Rhythms Cafe next Saturday, the 15th, at 7:30, Todd?
7:30, yep.
And are they all going to be on the stage together, the three of them?
Yes, they will. Yeah, and I'll emcee the show, and each of the poets will give a reading, and then there'll be a book signing to follow, and I'm sure many, many after parties throughout the town.
To get us to spring.
To get us to spring, absolutely.
Okay, so Christine, you have one poem you said you'd like to read today. This is one of those after the few that are really after-hour experience for you.
That's right.
And it's a bar that I have been in two or three times in the last 30-some years, but not in the last, I think the last time was probably 6 or 7 years ago. And it's changed. It's one of those sort of Grass Valley landmarks that is always there, but constantly in a new guise.
Yes, transformed. So this poem is called Me and Mr. Jones. Remember the silver dollar? Skanky little basement dive on a throwaway street in Grass Valley, CA, still coughing up stale tobacco 10 years after the ban, low customers scuttling downstairs like cockroaches, and a bouncer so mean, even brave men jaywalk to avoid him. It's different now, all uptown and sleek, sandblasted, drywalled, scoured, polished, no memory of bad whiskey or despair. Candlelight and cool jazz, timeless barkeep wiping down the long bar with the white cloth. Classic 1930, 40, or 2008, just opened, undiscovered, perfect setting for a tryst. We perch at our tiny table, sharing cabernet and gimlets, gazing at length without self-consciousness or fear. You talk and talk, it all makes sense, reflects my own musing, mingles with the perfect pitch of a tenor sax. But I have walked this path before, in other shoes, and I see ghosts pacing the walls, waiting huddled in the corner of the red leather couch. The flame flickers sweetly between us, turning your white shirt cream, dappling your beautiful neck with gold, though your blue eyes turn navy, dilating with desire. Eventually, we must go home again. And then there's this. Fulfillment nullifies desire, collapses possibilities, concretizes fantasy, defines the dream. I prefer potential shimmer, moving like a dancer, employing seven veils, synchronistic meeting, unplanned rendezvous. These are the swoops and darts of Eros, offering us much more than meets the eye.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Wonderful, right?
Right.
Oh, Todd, enough.
the proud publisher will be presenting his three poets this coming Saturday. It's going to be a two-for-one happy hour at the Rhythms Cafe on Main Street in Grass Valley, Saturday the 15th of November at 7:30 p.m. And the poets will be Christine Irving, who we've been talking with in the last 20 minutes, Noel Kroplin. They together have a chapbook called Sex on Earth and Other Sordid Locations. And what's Will Staples' book called again?
The One That Got Away.
Which is a very Will Staples-y topic and way of stating it. So they'll be there, and it'll be more of what you just heard from Christine, plus the other two who you haven't heard. Any last thoughts before we go?
I'm just hoping to see a lot of people, because it's really a lot more fun to play to a big crowd than a small crowd, and it's going to be a great evening and in great company.
This has been Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm going to make way right now for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.